Ian Lake. It's 8 o'clock. Good morning. This is Northern Light for Monday, September 13th. I'm Todd Moe. Monica Sandreski has the day off. This morning, we'll get a first-person account of what it's like to serve on a jury. Our Adirondack reporter Emily Russell recently served on a jury in a criminal trial. It was, in a word, stressful. So Emily reached out to experts to find out if that's how a lot of jurors feel.
There are specific kinds of cases that can engender stress in jurors. Death penalty cases, cases of sexual assault, and in particular child sexual assault and sexual abuse.
Also, we'll meet a young woman from Akwesasne who has worked a lot of jobs, from casinos to pumping gas, and always work that relied on her social skills.
Like, I never seen myself sitting at a desk job, so I always tried to look for something that wasn't so much like that. It's a lot of fun when you have a good day.
And naturalist and guide Rich McDonald loves birding and shares his joy in a new book, Little Big Year. So what did he learn from an intense year of spotting birds? All that's coming up on Northern Light. Stay tuned. Broadcast of Northern Light here on North Country Public Radio is supported by the Village Mercantile in Saranac Lake, established in 2011 with a mission of community-fueled solutions with essentials for home, camp, and gift-giving. VillageMerc.com, anything but general. And by the Ausable River Association, monitoring lakes and streams and finding solutions that reduce road salt pollution. Learn more at AusableRiver.org. 57 degrees in Canton right now, the Weather Service says. Partly cloudy skies for much of the region, sunshine along eastern Lake Ontario. Highs today ranging from the upper 60s into the mid-70s and light winds out of the southwest. This is Northern Light. I'm Todd Moe. There are criminal trials unfolding all the time here in the North Country. Many of them have juries, people like you and me, hearing the cases. But we rarely hear from those jurors. They're not allowed to discuss the trial while it's unfolding, but jurors are allowed to talk after a verdict has been reached. Our reporter Emily Russell recently served on a jury and says the experience left a lasting impact on her.
It started with a card in the mail. You've probably gotten one before, summoning you for jury duty. Well, a lot of people showed up on that first day. We were all interviewed, and I ended up being one of the 12 people chosen to serve on the jury for a criminal case. As a journalist, I do my best to keep my opinions out of my work. But for the next 4 days, my opinion, based on the evidence, was really the only job I had. I'm not going to go into the specifics of the case, just to say that it was a dark one. The alleged crime took place in a world of struggle, pain, neglect, and abuse. For those next 4 days, everyone in the courtroom was immersed in that world. The attorneys and people who testified painted this vivid picture. And as a juror, I felt like we were right there with them in some of the darkest moments of these people's lives. I was wrecked after the first day. We weren't allowed to talk about the case with anyone outside the courthouse. That's normal for a jury trial. But that left me with thoughts of the case flooding my mind at the end of each day. One juror told me she was having a hard time sleeping. That was about as much as we were allowed to say, even to each other. We weren't allowed to talk about the case to the other jurors until deliberation, until the judge gave us permission. So each day we'd be dismissed for lunch or for a 15-minute break and couldn't say anything about what we had just heard. We'd mostly just sit around in a heavy silence. That silence ceased on the final day of the trial. We heard closing arguments in the morning, and then around noon, the rest was up to us. What unfolded in the next few hours was intense. Here we all were, from all around the county, from really different backgrounds and life experiences. We shared our thoughts, our gut feelings, our own interpretation of the evidence. In the beginning of the trial, they tell you not to expect what you see on TV. There wasn't DNA evidence. The alleged crime wasn't caught on camera. It wasn't recorded in any way. So what we had was mostly just testimonies, what people remembered had happened years ago. We went back and forth over those testimonies. We reviewed the evidence we did have. And after hours of deliberating, we had a consensus. All 12 jurors found the defendant guilty. We walked back into the courtroom with our verdict. The defendant was there. The families involved in the case were there. For me, that was the hardest moment of all, one I'll never forget. I felt confident in our guilty verdict, but I knew, in part because of my opinion, people's lives were about to change forever. The judge accepted our verdict, and just like that, it was over. We were dismissed and walked out of the courthouse. We're all now allowed to talk about what happened that week with our families, with the media, with anyone. I've done a lot of that lately, processing what we heard, what we saw, what we ultimately decided, and I'll likely keep processing in the weeks and months to come. Emily Russell, North Country Public Radio.
That was our reporter, Emily Russell, sharing some of her experience serving on a jury for a recent criminal trial. And Emily joins me now to talk more about what she learned about jury duty since. Hi, Emily. Oh, we seem to have lost the connection with Emily. We'll try to get her back on the line in just a moment and continue that conversation about jury duty and her experience, and we'll hear from some legal experts. That's coming up in just a few minutes. Moving on to another story, being young often means trying out lots of different jobs, bouncing around until you figure out what you like. One woman who grew up on the Akwesasne Mohawk Reservation near Messina worked at a gas station, at the casino, a donut store, and took away experiences from each one. Anna Williams-Bergen has her story for today's installment of our North Country at Work series.
29-year-old Kylie Mitchell Gibson is upbeat with an infectious smile. It's no wonder she leans towards jobs that are customer service oriented.
Like, I never seen myself sitting at a desk job, so I always tried to look for something that wasn't so much like that. It's a lot of fun when you have a good day.
After finishing high school at Cornwall Collegiate and Vocational School in 2011, Mitchell Gibson lived and worked all over Ontario. It was family that brought her back to Akwesasne. Since returning, she said she's had a pretty easy time finding employment. One of her favorite gigs was working as a gas pumper. She says it was fun, and she was popular.
Especially around this area, there's not many female gas pumpers. And that alone was enough to get people to come back to the gas station I was working at and say, like, oh, no, I want her to pump my gas. I want the girl to do it because, you know, she's the only girl gas pumper on the whole res.
Working in the service industry also means dealing with people on their bad days, which Mitchell Gibson says she had to get used to.
I was working at a Tim Hortons. That also helped me deal with people being unhappy about things. My favorite was when people come up and go to grab a coffee and they ask what it is and you tell them and they're like, oh, that ain't my order. And I'm like, yeah, I know it's not your order. I wasn't. It's that guy's order.
Then she started tending bar at the Akwesasne Mohawk Casino Resort. Mitchell Gibson got into the nightlife when she was living near Toronto and says bartending was a way of getting back into the lifestyle without all the drinking.
I'm naturally like nocturnal, I call it. My mornings are noons. Whenever I was looking for a job that would help fit my schedule, bartending always seemed like a good choice.
Mitchell Gibson says bartending taught her a lot, especially about social skills.
I'm a severe introvert throughout my teenage years, and I realized, like, I need to stop. I need to get out and enjoy the world, enjoy things, and you can't do that just keeping to yourself too often. I learned how to kind of like read people better, like how to approach people.
She says her favorite part of bartending was getting to know all kinds of people, both locals and those from far away.
It's talking to those people where you wouldn't imagine them coming from that type of situation. There's every once in a while you'll see somebody come up and you can tell they're not from around the area. So automatically you go over, you spark up conversation, and it's always really interesting to know people's stories.
These days, Mitchell Gibson works at Six Bears Dispensary as a bud tender, getting customers different products and weighing out marijuana. She loves the work, she says, but she doesn't plan to stay at the dispensary forever. She still has more jobs to try. For North Country Public Radio's North Country at Work, I'm Anna Williams-Bergen in Akwesasne.
North Country at Work is a long-running project of NCPR that collects work photos and stories from around our region. And if you have someone you think we should profile, email us at work@ncpr.org. So a few minutes ago, we heard our reporter Emily Russell sharing her experience serving on a jury for a recent criminal trial, and we want to follow up with that story. Emily joins me now to talk more about what she learned about jury duty service. Hey, Emily.
Hey, good morning, Todd.
So you walked us through what jury duty was like for you, and I'm curious, do you know if that's the typical experience of a juror, or was this, a particularly difficult case?
Yeah, I was really curious about that after my experience being so stressful. So I reached out to a couple of experts. One of them was Valerie Hans. She teaches at Cornell Law School and studies the jury system. And I asked her how common my jury duty experience was.
The good news is that in the vast majority of cases where juries serve, they come to the courts, they listen to the testimony, they deliberate with other jurors, they arrive at a verdict, and feel good about their experience at the end of the day. There are specific kinds of cases that can engender stress in jurors. The most common are death penalty cases, cases of sexual assault, and in particular, child sexual assault and sexual abuse.
You know, in those kinds of cases, Han says, jurors may have to see some pretty gruesome evidence or hear difficult testimonies. We don't have the death penalty in New York, but dozens of other states still do. And it's an incredible weight to put on jurors.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. And are there resources available for jurors that serve on those kinds of trials to deal with that stress or that trauma?
What I learned was there's not really a standard system in place across the U.S. You know, there's no card that you get at the end of a jury duty that says, you know, call this number if you're experiencing stress. I also spoke with Gregory Mize. He's a retired judge. He works now with the National Center for State Courts. And Mize told me that Massachusetts does now provide counselors to jurors, and Canada actually has a system to provide support for jurors.
They've created a commission that's devoted to helping Canadian jurors with PTSD. So there's an example of a central effort, and that was instituted within the last 12 to 18 months.
So, Emily, I'm wondering if your jury duty experience changed the way you think about the justice system.
It's interesting. I hadn't even really thought about what the experience was like until I did it. You know, like you said in my intro, we just don't hear from jurors all that often. And despite having this really tough, stressful case and just an intense experience overall, it made me really grateful that people like you and me and our neighbors play a role in these cases. Like I said, the people I served with came into the trial with, you know, different backgrounds, different perspectives, and that really came through in the hours it took for us to deliberate. You know, to come to a verdict, we had to have a unanimous consensus. So everyone on the jury was really thoughtful and really thorough, and we took our duty on this case really seriously.
Okay, Emily Russell, our Adirondack reporter, sharing her experience serving jury duty here in the North Country. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Todd.
Thank you. It's 8:15. You are listening to Northern Light here on North Country Public Radio. I'm Todd Moe. Monica Sandreski will be back tomorrow. Stay tuned. We'll be chatting with a naturalist and a bird expert who lives in Maine, but spent a lot of time in the North Country and the Adirondacks studying birds. He has a new book out. We'll find out more from Rich McDonald coming up in just a few minutes. Stay tuned. 59 degrees here in Canton right now, and the Weather Service says highs today upper 60s, low 70s. This is Potsdam cellist Beth Robinson. Broadcast of Northern Light is supported by the Arc Jefferson St. Lawrence, supporting individuals with disabilities to achieve their goals for more fulfilled lives. The Arc, JSLC.org, the Arc Jefferson St. Lawrence, achieve with us. And by Thomas J. Lombard, P.E. Keysville, providing engineering planning and environmental consulting services to Northern New York and Vermont, 518-834-7729. The Lewis County General Hospital will stop delivering babies later this month. CEO Gerald Kayer called the closure of the maternity department a pause. He said it was necessary because six staff members resigned last week rather than be vaccinated against the coronavirus, leaving the ward too understaffed to remain open. The New York State Health Department mandated that all healthcare workers be fully vaccinated by September 27th. The Watertown Daily Times reported that on Friday, Kayer said that 30 people have resigned since the mandate was announced in late August. 20 were clinical positions like nurses or therapists. He said he hopes the maternity department will be able to reopen. Lewis County reported the highest 7 and 14-day positivity rates in the whole state during the past week. There were protests around the North Country last week against the statewide vaccine mandate for healthcare workers. Former Governor Cuomo mandated that all healthcare workers be vaccinated against COVID-19 by the end of this month, but some say they will refuse the shot. According to the Adirondack Daily Enterprise, healthcare workers protested outside Adirondack Medical Center in Saranac Lake last Wednesday. One woman who had been a nurse for 25 years told the paper she believes the vaccine will cause cancer, which is not true. According to the Watertown Daily Times, healthcare workers at Samaritan Medical also protested the vaccine mandate last week, threatening to quit before being vaccinated. The overwhelming consensus among medical experts around the world is that the vaccines are safe and highly effective. All healthcare workers are required to have at least one dose of the COVID-19 vaccine by September 27th. St. Lawrence University will continue its high alert status for another 2 weeks to continue to slow the spike in cases of COVID-19. There were 71 new cases last week, a decrease from 119 the previous week. The university announced it's adjusting some of its restrictions. The changes include lowering the number of vaccinated students who are required to be tested. Outdoor masking is no longer required, and students are allowed to be at gatherings of 15 or less. That's up from 10. Unvaccinated staff and students at St. Lawrence are still required to follow all previous testing and masking requirements. Parents of adults with severe autism and other disabilities say New York officials are threatening to revoke funding for their children's long-term care at out-of-state care centers unless they agree to send their children to a secure in-state facility. The Times Union of Albany reported yesterday that some parents believe they have no alternative but to send their adult children to the Sunmount Developmental Center in Franklin County in the Adirondacks. They describe the facility as remote and prison-like. Some state lawmakers have asked Governor Kathy Hochul to end the policy. The State Office for People with Developmental Disabilities says a legal process prevents it from funding for out-of-state care at a certain point. And Senators Charles Schumer and Kirsten Gillibrand are pushing for $33 million in federal funding to upgrade weather warning systems across the state and the country in response to the deadly flooding rains dumped by the remnants of Hurricane Ida. The senator said yesterday that a web of 126 observation stations in New York needs upgrading and money for maintenance as climate change makes weather forecasting more difficult. It's 8:21. You're listening to Northern Lights here on North Country Public Radio. I'm Todd Moe. Monica Sandreski has the day off. Thanks for joining us. Highs today in the upper 60s, low 70s, with a mix of sun and clouds and light winds out of the southwest. Biologist and birder Rich McDonald has spent most of his career in northern forests from the North Country to Maine. His new book, Little Big Year, documents the birds of Acadia National Park on the coast of Maine. But he learned a lot about birding while living and working in the Adirondacks. A dedicated outdoor adventurer, McDonald is a registered guide in New York and Maine, where he runs the Natural History Center in Bar Harbor. It's a family business that offers birding and nature hikes. You'll often find Rich outdoors with binoculars strapped over his shoulder as he listens for the birds. He's working on a second book about a greener big year, a term birders use for a personal challenge or an informal competition among birders who attempt to identify as many species of birds as possible by sight or sound in a year. I caught up with him in between birding hikes to talk about his first book, Little Big Year. Did you, as the author, you know, what do you glean from this book? And, you know, did you sort of learn something from this Little Big Year?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, I've been birding since I was a kid, so we're talking now, you know, 40 plus years, and there's been a lot of changes over time. There's this wonderful citizen science app called eBird that some of your listeners will know, and eBird has got so much data in it now, you can actually look at how populations of birds have changed over time. I've seen that. I remember being a kid, and the woods were alive with birds, and today there's definitely a noticeably lower amount of birds, and the data supports that too. We just see less birds, and spending a year about that, I'm out there looking for birds, some birds that used to be common here in Maine, like maybe not common, but a bird you could find, such as Eastern Meadowlark. That's one I find in the Champlain Valley. At least I did when I lived in the Adirondacks. I would go find in the Champlain Valley, and we'd find in grasslands here in Maine. And now it's really hard to find, and their population is down tremendously. It's really alarming how much their population is down, and that's directly tied to things like habitat loss, as we have converted grasslands to either monoculture agriculture or to subdivisions, and or even in some cases, like in a lot of northern New York, a lot of these grasslands historically were forests. We cleared them for farming, and now they're reverting to forest again. And so we're losing habitat from the Midwest, from the prairie provinces to the coast. We're losing grasslands, and the meadowlark was an example of one that is really hard to find. And I think that whole year I found one meadowlark, where 20 plus years ago, I probably would have found a dozen or more. So that was certainly something we saw. There weren't a lot of stories where I was excited to say, wow, the birds have increased. Maybe the one case that I did see that was the cardinal. The northern cardinal was a bird that 20 years ago was really rare in Bar Harbor, and their range has been expanding really tremendously. They deal very well with human habitation and development. So we went from no cardinals or virtually no cardinals in Bar Harbor to a lot of cardinals. I know when I visit my mom in Canton, we see cardinals there. And I don't remember cardinals as something that was part of the avian landscape in the High Peaks region when I lived there. So they may have been around, but I don't have a memory of them being a regular thing. And I don't see a lot of them even now when I'm in the High Peaks, but I'm not in like Saranac Lake or Lake Placid a lot. I'm usually out in the mountains or on the lakes. So in habitat that's not quite cardinal habitat. Yeah. So I would love to hear, you know, if some of your listeners say, oh yeah, we do have a lot of cardinals, that'd be great. I do find them in Canton, that I know.
One of the philosophies of your book is that what I liked about it as a very much an amateur birder is your notion that you want people just to get outside. And if you see all these great birds, fantastic. But just the opportunity to be outside, as you say, listening to the wind in the trees, hearing the birds, seeing signs of wildlife, that's reason enough to, you know, to be part of the natural world.
Yes, absolutely. And that was something I learned as a kid growing up in Western New York. And my when I was a kid, my birding mentor was this gentleman, Jerry Farrell. And he always said, you're not going to see anything if you don't go looking. And, you know, I think about kids today and how so many of us have children or grandchildren and know kids that are, you know, tied to their electronic devices. And I find, you know, what does it take to get them outside so that they're not just, you know, couch potatoes? And things like showing them wild animals certainly helps. Bigger wild animals often gets them more engaged. Bird banding is a great way to get them engaged because you put a wild animal in a kid's hand. And I swear it changes them, especially if you can get it in that crucial age, kind of 8 to about 12 or 13 or 14. It really has an impact on them. They might not become ornithologists or biologists, but, you know, it moves them in a way that they always remember. Also, you need to kind of approach them on their own terms. Technology is so important to kids today. So, you know, there's some wonderful citizen science apps like eBird, like iNaturalist, and you can get kids, you know, show them the apps, and then, you know, who's going to be the note taker today? Let's go out, let's document these our sightings, whether it's a plant or an animal, a bird, whatever it is, and share our data with scientists. So we're contributing to science. And the kids really get excited about actually using the apps on their devices. And suddenly they're making a connection, not even realizing they're using their device and they're learning about nature and they're outside. So I feel like I'm kind of tricking them into doing what I want them to do, but I'm also meeting them halfway by letting them use their apps.
So the pandemic, do you think people are getting a little more reconnected with the natural world because of the pandemic? I mean, we hear anecdotes about people wanting to take hikes more and stay closer to home and that kind of thing. What are you hearing and seeing?
Yes, people are definitely getting more connected to the natural world. And I think there's so many things involved. Combination of, you know, 18 months or whatever it was of being cooped up, not being able to go out as much as you would like. And then, you know, global travel has really been significantly curtailed. And people are just itching to go on vacation. When I was in the Adirondacks in August and on our canoe trip, we saw so many people. And my take was not like, oh my God, there's so many tourists. My take was like, it's great. People are out here enjoying nature. And hopefully if they enjoy it enough, they'll want to have more of the natural world protected. They'll become stakeholders, support groups like the Nature Conservancy or their local land trust. And they'll start caring about birds. And we definitely saw that, like, you know, part of my business, I sell binoculars. So in a typical year, I'll sell 20 or 30 pair of binoculars. During the pandemic, I sold over 100 pair of binoculars. So that's just, there's a measurable statistic there. This year, tourism is up over 30% in the Acadia region. And I see that with my tours. My bird tours are up easily 30%. I've had so many people reach out to me, Rich, I'm getting into birding. I want an introductory bird lesson. In fact, I have one scheduled for this afternoon. And so you see that everywhere. You know, my friends in the Adirondacks are telling me that they're seeing more people on the trails. There's more, you know, my friend Doug from 80K Bike is saying, you know, more people are engaged in this program. So to me, it's a really good thing, getting people involved in nature. And a place like Acadia and really a lot of the Adirondacks are so driven by tourism. That's, you know, it's bringing more tourist dollars and helps the economy locally. So while some people might grouse about the downside, I certainly see, you know, the good side, and people maybe aren't traveling by air as much. My gut is that there's less pollution. We certainly saw it during the pandemic, and we saw more people engaged in just bird watching. And I was doing a bunch of Zoom meetings where people could come online and hear about my book or talk about birds, and the participation was tremendous. So I think it is a real thing that people have gotten more engaged in the natural world and realize this is really empowering to go out there and hike and learn and be in the woods and learn to not be afraid of the wildlife, but to be respectful. So I see it as a great thing. I think that more people are engaged.
Biologist and birder Rich McDonald's new book is called Little Big Year. It documents the birds of Acadia National Park on the coast of Maine. He also spends a lot of time birding here in the North Country. You can find it at the Brewer Bookstore in Canton and ask for Little Big Year at your favorite local bookstore. There's more information at ncpr.org. It's 8:30. That'll do it for Northern Light for this Monday. I'm Todd Moe. Thanks for listening. Be well.